All eyes in the Arab world are focused on Israel and the occupied territories today, where Mahmoud Abbas has been declared the winner in yesterday's presidential elections. This comes 2 months after the death of the first president of the Palestinian Authority, Yasser Arafat. We'll have more on the Palestinian election later in the program, but first, the other story captivating the Arab press. Less than 24 hours ago, Sudan's Islamic government signed a peace agreement with Christian and animist rebels in the south of the country, putting an end to Africa's longest-running civil war. One Kenyan mediator called the agreement a precious child to nurture with love and care. The accord calls for the armies of both groups to merge and gives the South an option down the road to secede. It also limits the application of strict Islamic law to the northern Islamic regions, but it doesn't cover the Darfur region of Sudan, racked by a separate conflict that's been called a genocide. Matthew Green covers Sudan for Reuters. He joins us on the line from Nairobi, Kenya. And Matthew, let's talk first about what the accord does do. You know, after more than 20 years of this north-south civil war, the accord mandates that mines be removed, that new currency be created, and eventually that a referendum be held in the south to determine whether that area will remain part of Sudan. What is the assumption? Is it assumed that the Christian south will secede?
Well, Robin, that is the million-dollar question. Obviously, there's many southerners who say that they would like to leave the south after what they regard as many, many years of oppression by the Islamic government in the north. On the other hand, the northerners would very much like to keep the country together. A lot of the country's oil reserves lie in the south. So obviously, there's a big interest from their point of view in ensuring that the South doesn't vote for secession.
And perhaps to go to that end, the accord calls for a sharing of those oil riches in the South. Previously, the South had been excluded from much of that, and co-governing. But as we said, the accord doesn't cover the Darfur conflict between the government-backed Arab militia and rebel separatists in Darfur. Why?
Well, the origins of this peace agreement go back over several years to really before the Darfur conflict really erupted. This peace agreement that was signed on Sunday only covers the civil war in the south, which, as you say, has been running for 20 or so years. And there's a whole history of peace attempts, of which this is the latest and obviously the most successful manifestation. Darfur is hundreds of miles away in the west of Sudan, a huge country, actually the biggest in Africa. That's a conflict that's a more recent phenomenon and therefore hasn't yet made the same amount of progress in terms of peace negotiations.
Right. Well, people, despite the fact that Darfur still remains, an unsettling question, people seem to be euphoric about this accord that was signed and attested to in Nairobi. What was the reaction of the many Sudanese in Kenya?
Well, many of them were absolutely ecstatic. There are many Sudanese refugees in Kenya, at least 80,000 of them, and many of them will be looking forward to returning home now that peace has returned to the south. That in itself won't necessarily be straightforward. As you can imagine, the war in the south has really ravaged the place. It's one of the most undeveloped corners of the world. There's very few roads, very little electricity, very little clean water. So it's really a question of them rebuilding from scratch. But certainly many of them are very keen to go back to their homeland after what amounts to decades in exile in neighboring Kenya.
Is there a sense that this is going to work in the long run?
Well, certainly there's a lot of optimism on both sides, both from the government side and from the rebel side, that this could really be a chance for ending this conflict in the south of Sudan. There's a long road ahead, as in all of these kinds of agreements. Certainly there's issues about fragmentation of rebel groups, with certain parts of the southern rebel forces perhaps not being totally happy with the accord. It is a large lawless area in southern Sudan. And of course, when the vote comes up for secession of the south, possibly in six years' time, that could provide another flashpoint for tension. But certainly there's a lot of optimism that after literally years of painstaking negotiations, this might really be a lasting breakthrough.
And just in the few seconds we have, Matthew, how will it affect or will it affect other conflicts in Africa?
Well, it may not necessarily have a direct impact straight away, although there is civil war running in neighboring Uganda, bordering Sudan, which borders Sudan. Many of the rebels from Uganda are actually based in southern Sudan. So there is some optimism now that if peace can return to the south of Sudan, then that will help to resolve the conflict in neighboring Uganda. So this could really be good news for a large swathe of Central Africa.
Matthew Green covers Sudan for Reuters. Matthew, thanks very much. Well, speaking of Uganda, the government whistleblower who raised red flags about a drug that forms the backbone of the White House effort to prevent AIDS in Uganda and in Africa is speaking out again. Dr. Jonathan Fishbein is a researcher at the National Institutes of Health. He claims he's being fired because he made public some concerns about a study in Uganda involving the retroviral drug nevirapine, concerns that weren't conveyed to the White House. Last week, Dr. Fishbein spoke publicly for the first time, telling an independent panel of scientists that the U.S.-funded study of the drug endangered the lives of hundreds of patients in Uganda. He's agreed to speak with us as his lawyers listen in. Later, we'll speak with a doctor in Uganda who's involved in the NIH study and supports the work being done. But first, Dr. Fishbein, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak with you.
And as you know, nevirapine was touted as a drug that would stop the transmission of AIDS from mothers to children. The NIH believes it saved hundreds of thousands of African babies. What are you saying that the drug did or could possibly do instead?
Well, here's what I really want to make clear is that my issue is not nevirapine. My issue is the conduct of the trial. The issue is a research integrity issue, okay? And I really would like the public to understand that. I'm not taking a stand about nevirapine per se. I'm taking a stand about how the NIH permitted that study to be conducted and how they have covered up what has been shown to be very, very negligent research practices.
Well, remind us about the study, first of all, and then some of the cover-ups, which some of them have been admitted to. Start with the study.
Well, the HIFNET-012 study enrolled about 642 mother-infant pairs to compare one dose of nevirapine head-to-head with AZT.
In other words, the doses were given to try to block the transmission of AIDS from the mother to the child.
From pregnant mothers to their newborns.
And this was in Uganda?
This was done in Uganda starting about 1997 to 1999 when they completed enrollment and have since been doing long-term follow-up.
And what were the problems with that?
Well, the problem was with the conduct of the study. And what happened was by virtue of the fact that the manufacturer of the drug, Boehringer Ingelheim, decided to submit an application to the FDA for approval of this drug for the specific indication, there were audits conducted. And the drug company sent its own auditors to Kampala to look at the way the study was conducted to provide them some reassurance prior to the FDA going there for a look. And what Boehringer Ingelheim found was very, very alarming. They found a lot of serious compliance issues, and the one that was most prominent had to do with adverse event reporting, how untoward events that occurred during the trial to the study subjects, how those were recorded.
What kinds of adverse effects?
Well, you know, in this setting, in Uganda, there are many, many endemic illnesses in a predominantly poor population. But what you're looking for is evidence that there are side effects caused by the drug. There is a well-known side effect, which is liver toxicity.
This was known before it was ever taken to Uganda.
Yeah. But the thing with this regimen in this trial was it was one dose to the mother or one to the infant. And what has subsequently been found is that the HIV-positive mothers, about half of them, as many as half of them, become resistant. In other words, they develop a mutation of HIV that is resistant to nevirapine. Mm. And nevirapine being really one of the only available antiviral drugs in these countries because it's inexpensive, if that is no longer among the possible drugs available to these women, then they're without any type of antiretroviral protection. And so, in effect, they take a serious risk, and they could die. And what you may, in the end, save the child, but you've killed the mother, so you've produced an orphan.
Mm. Well, we understand that because of these concerns, the National Institutes of Health suspended the study in 2002, but the NIH AIDS research chief, Dr. Edmund Tremont, has admitted that he deleted these unfavorable findings about the drug from a safety report and ordered the research to continue.
Well, this study came nowhere near meeting a research standard called good clinical practice. So the NIH obviously was very embarrassed by this, but did not bother to tell the White House about these compliance issues prior to the White House rolling out an initiative of about $500 million, which would provide nevirapine to women in Africa. So they made a choice not to inform the president and let this initiative go forward. That's disgraceful behavior.
Even if it, as the NIH has said, saves thousands of those babies.
That's not an excuse.
Yeah.
That's not an excuse.
Dr. Fishbein, the Justice Department is now investigating this issue, but why do you think that someone would do this?
I think they were overzealous in trying to get countries like South Africa, who are fearful of Western medicine and drugs,
trying to get them
to feel comfortable with a drug like nevirapine. And the best way to do that is get the FDA to approve it. When the FDA approves it, then, you know, the regulatory authorities in those countries may feel more comfortable. And I think that the NIH tolerated sloppy research and then tried to cover it up, and they continued to cover it up by intimidating and enacting reprisal against any employees, such as myself, who expressed some sort of dissent with the way that the study was conducted and the way the government has handled it. And that's disgraceful. What kind of government does something like that?
In fact, the NIH denies that you're losing your job because of this accusation. But I'm wondering, too, some people think that Western countries are causing AIDS in Africa, and then you have this report of a drug that may actually cause some harm.
Well, I don't think that we are spreading AIDS to those countries. I don't think that it's a Western plot, certainly.
Well, of course not, but I mean,
I know,
you know, does this add to that?
Well, there is suspicion. There's suspicion, but the important thing is that we should permit the Africans to make informed decisions on their own regarding the use of nevirapine. And their physicians should fully disclose the risks and the benefits of the drug to the women they are offering the drug to, and give them truthful information. And we should be the source of truthful information.
Dr. Jonathan Fishbein is a researcher at the National Institutes of Health. He says his job was on the line there because he blew the whistle on a study in Africa involving the anti-AIDS drug nevirapine. Doctor, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
And when we return, we'll speak with an African woman, a Ugandan doctor involved in the nevirapine study. She has a very different point of view. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now. Continuing our discussion of the controversy surrounding a study of the anti-AIDS drug nevirapine in Uganda. We just heard from government whistleblower Dr. Jonathan Fishbein, who says the study was shoddy science and that concerns about it weren't conveyed to the White House. He's now fighting for his job at the National Institutes of Health. The NIH was unable to provide us with a spokesperson today, but they say they won't comment because an investigation is underway. The NIH does admit the study was flawed, but they say the benefits of nevirapine outweigh the few risks. And many AIDS activists agree, including Dr. Philippa Musoke. She's chairperson of the Department of Pediatrics at Makerere University School of Medicine. She was one of the co-investigators of the NIH study involving nevirapine. She joins us from her office in Kampala. And welcome, Dr. Musoke.
Thank you very much.
And let's have a quick review, because there's a lot of information here. Nevirapine had already been approved as an antiretroviral, meaning it could fight AIDS. The makers wanted a new approval. They said it would block transmission of HIV from mother to child, and so the NIH commissioned this study. Your group did the study, correct?
That is correct.
Right. Do you agree that the study was flawed?
Let me first say that the study was actually conducted as well as we could have done it in the time in Uganda by Ugandans. The study wasn't perfect, and we have acknowledged that, but there was nothing done out of fraud or in an effort to minimize risk to the participants. Every effort was made to take care of the participants, and I think the minor errors that were recorded or that were brought up were issues related to documentation, but the patients were followed closely and nobody was put at risk.
Yeah. Dr. Fishbein says that there were serious compliance issues with reporting the adverse effects of the drug, and even whistleblower Fishbein says the drug is worth trying. But his concern was that it also increased the mother's resistance later on to other retrovirals and that they were not informed of that, the mothers. Are the mothers now informed that there are some risks?
Yes. Let me just go back and say that the study was done initially without the knowledge that there was resistance after single-dose nevirapine. The single-dose nevirapine was given to the mother and to the infant, and as you already know, there was a significant reduction in transmission of HIV from mother to child.
By 50%.
I do want to say something about 50%, yes, significant.
Yes.
I do want to say something about the adverse events. There were very few adverse events that were considered that maybe they could have been related to the drug. And it has been documented as well and published in studies that there is this chance of resistance developing. Now it's well known in the scientific world, and we're sharing it with our patients now that a single dose nevirapine does have this issue, especially as they start highly active antiretroviral therapy.
What do you say to people who might wonder that the study appears to come to a conclusion that's an ideological choice that favors the health of the child over the health of the mother?
Well, people have brought that ethical issue. And in fact, when we first started the study and got the results, people were saying you're only concerned about the baby and not the mother. But the truth is, for any mother, I think you'd want to take care of your child as well as yourself. And so what we're recommending, many of these mothers, when they are given single-dose nevirapine, they don't need antiretroviral therapy for themselves at the time. If they need therapy for themselves later, then that's another issue. That is very important because we know the survival of the infant or the baby depends on the survival of the mother
right.
as well.
Right. But still, you do have research that shows that about 60 of the 300 women who are on nevirapine developed a resistance while they stayed on nevirapine to AIDS-fighting drugs. Is that equation in the short term worth it for you, given that thousands of babies were saved, were prevented from getting HIV? Are you comfortable with that trade-off?
To be honest, I'm really comfortable with the trade-off right now because we do not have enough information yet to say that if a mother has a resistant mutation and she needs the therapy for herself, let's say 6 months later, that if she takes the treatment, that she'll actually die. While if we don't give the single dose nevirapine to the mother, in our context, that's what we have. When there are other drugs that can be used, if single dose, if nevirapine is not as cannot be used, we can always use other drugs. Granted, they're not as easily available, but they are available within the country. So I think it's a trade-off. If I were a mother myself and they told me there's a chance I wouldn't infect my baby, but there's a potential risk of resistance in the future, I'd save my baby.
And Dr. Musoke, how many women are we talking about? How bad is the infection of women in Uganda?
About 60,000 women who are HIV infected deliver each year. Mm. Every year, 60,000 women are exposing their babies to HIV. Now, not all the mothers who are HIV infected pass the infection on to their babies. It's about 25 to 30% without single-dose nevirapine. So in our calculations, we expect that if there's no access to single-dose nevirapine, we'd have about 18,000 infected babies if nothing is done.
So these are decisions you have to make.
Yeah, the decisions you have to make. Because once the baby's infected, they're infected. There's nothing we can do. We can always say they can access treatment and heart, but the mortality of our children who are infected Our infant mortality is about 100 per 1,000 in Uganda. We're one of the developing countries. When the child is HIV infected, the mortality is 300 per 1,000.
Dr. Philippa Musoke is chairperson of the Department of Pediatrics at Makerere University School of Medicine in Kampala in Uganda. She was one of the co-investigators of the NIH study involving nevirapine. Dr. Musoke, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, architects draw up plans to rebuild in the wake of the Asian tsunami. Plus, a conversation with Sean Penn about his role in the new film, The Assassination of Richard Nixon, and his part in protesting the war in Iraq. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. There is some optimism in the Middle East today following the election of Mahmoud Abbas to succeed the late Yasser Arafat as president of the Palestinian Authority. That optimism is guarded on the Israeli side of the equation as Israel waits to see what the new president's first moves will be and whether he'll try to subdue militant Palestinian groups. Mary Eisen is a former spokesperson for the Israeli government. She's a retired colonel in the Israeli Defense Forces and also worked as an Israeli intelligence official until last summer. She spoke earlier today with Here Now's Bob Oakes.
Mary, it was pretty clear from the start of the campaigning that Abbas would be the winner. In mid-December, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said he hoped the new year would bring the opportunity for an historic breakthrough in relations. And this morning, Israeli leaders say they're welcoming the apparent victory of Abbas. And I'm wondering whether you think this optimism, at least at the beginning, is well-placed or misplaced.
It's a great question, and I think that we really should be hopeful. There is a change in the air, and the change in the air is on both sides. The Palestinians on January 9th, yesterday, for the first time, went out and went to elections, and they may not yet be a real democracy, but what we saw yesterday was a real democratic election, probably the first one in the Arab world, and I think that if we look at the Arab media, even the different Arab states around looked around and said, hey, things can be different. They had options. They went out. They chose a candidate. It wasn't 99.9% for one single candidate. I think that Israelis are speaking differently, and they're hopeful because of this opportunity that somebody is talking not just about violence, not just about attacking and killing Israelis, but rather about compromise. And it's a harshful compromise on both sides. But yes, it is hopeful times.
Let me come back to the peace process in just a second. But first, let me ask you a question about the elections. What do you think that result says about how Palestinians viewed this election?
Let's think of how many people have participated in Western elections. If 60% of the population actually participate, people went out in droves to elect a new leader of the Palestinians yesterday, and that says a lot. I know that here in America, it looks like a huge percentage, but you have to understand that in the Middle East, presidents are voted in on 99%, and for the first time, there was a real person, and there were additional candidates, and they got a large percentage. The question is about the people who didn't vote and those who voted against. Will they accept that exact democratic system, or are they going to go out and start shooting or fighting against the results? I think only time can tell, but what's amazing is that today already, the Hamas, who were the ones who said to boycott the elections and not to go at all into the elections, have said that they'll accept the results. And I think that that's a real important stage in letting Abu Mazen do something within the Palestinian Authority. Does it bring peace, calm, vision? Not yet, but it certainly is a right step in the right direction.
On one hand, if you were Hamas, why wouldn't you say that you're going to work with him, at least at the beginning? And isn't subduing militant groups Abbas's chief obstacle right now?
It certainly is, and I think that that's going to be the one thing that not only are the Palestinians, but certainly the Israelis and the Western world are going to be watching. At the end of the day, there are two different issues that are on the table. The Palestinians are looking at this on their desire to achieve a state. They talk about it clearly, and Mahmoud Abbas was clear about it throughout his election. They're talking about a Palestinian state, about East Jerusalem as the capital, about issues which are not easy for the Israelis to accept, but this is part of the compromise. I don't know where they will go. Hamas has not accepted that basic compromise. The fact that they're willing to talk with Mahmoud Abbas and say that they're willing to work with him does not yet mean that they're willing to accept a compromise and to realize Israel's right to exist side to side by a Palestinian state. Time will tell, and I think that the biggest thing that Israelis are waiting to see is what will Mahmoud Abbas do with the Hamas. There are different ideas of what you can do. You can say, okay, until now you did terror. From now, stop the rocket firing on Israeli towns in and around the Gaza Strip, and we'll start out from here. And we're going to have to see if he does say these things, if the Hamas respond, how they respond, and if we can go from there. Because if they do go against the idea of a nonviolent negotiation and arriving at a compromise, and I don't see the Hamas arriving at a compromise, then it really does seem that we are going to be in an impasse between Hamas and Fatah. And the big question is, will the Palestinians take care of it?
Let me ask you to speculate about what you think the short and long-term relations between the U.S. and the Palestinian Authority might be in the immediate and long-term future. In a statement issued just 2 hours after the polls closed from the White House, President Bush called the election of Mahmoud Abbas an historic day for the Palestinian people and said the U.S. stands ready to help the Palestinians realize their aspirations. But again, short-term and long-term relationships from your point of view.
I think that what we will see is a big difference in the basic willingness of the United States to acknowledge the Palestinian side, just as with the Israelis after the passing of Arafat, and the fact that the Palestinians now have chosen somebody who has spoken outside in Arabic and in English, both against violence, not necessarily recognizing Israel's right to exist, but talking about a two-state solution and talking about compromise. I think that the United States will be looking differently at the Palestinians, but that they're also, just like the Israelis, waiting to see, are the Palestinians serious about taking care of terrorism, about changing something in their own house? The Palestinians didn't turn into a democracy overnight. It is a process, but what they did yesterday was a very big step in the direction of democracy, and I think that we will agree that democracy is an important component of changing the Palestinians into something that we can talk to more. I think the United States is going to see what else is going to happen. What will Mahmoud Abbas do first? Is he going to go up now and talk with the militants and say, everything's okay, you can continue to be terrorists and attack Israel? Can you continue to have rocket attacks? Or is he actually going to try and do something against the violence which has been committed against Israel for the last 4.5 years? That's what will impact the United States in deciding how to associate with this new Palestinian Authority. You have to give them a little bit also. I mean, they've done a huge step yesterday, and I do hope that both the Israelis and the Americans acknowledge the fact, as they have, that what happened yesterday was a historic event for the Palestinians.
Mary Eisen is a retired colonel in the Israeli Defense Forces and a former spokesperson for the Israeli government. She spoke earlier with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Still to come, parents are divided at a Catholic school in California. Some say two students should be expelled because their parents are gay. We ask, what would Jesus do? That story and more coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. The first week of 2005 was a white-knuckle ride for the U.S. airline industry. Delta Airlines kicked off a fare war that experts say will cost the industry billions in revenue. Bankrupt United Airlines is still trying to negotiate new, tight-fisted labor contracts to cut operating costs. And airline stocks suffered going into the new year. Well, financial reporter Mark Mills joins us now to look at turbulent times for America's air carriers. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Robin.
And I wonder, first of all, why would Delta launching a fare war cost the industry $2 billion. I know Merrill Lynch is one of the analysts saying that. Why?
Well, that was really the total. If the whole industry went along with this, that the lower fares obviously would mean less revenue coming in. And thus far, American Airlines responded the day after Delta's announcement, but other major airlines, United, Continental, Northwest, US Air, have not yet joined the fray because it could be very damaging to their businesses to lose so much revenue, even though they will have trouble competing with Delta and American in these lower fares.
Right, and even though they may also have empty seats. By the way, is that why Delta did this?
It is not only to fill empty seats, it's to get the more lucrative business market back. You know, for years, the airlines had a pricing structure where you had business people who tend to book late and not stay over Saturday nights paying a lot of money, and then leisure travelers who could book well in advance and stay over a Saturday buying the cheap seats to kind of fill up the rest of the plane. Well, when you had the low-cost air carriers coming in, such as Southwest and JetBlue, they started offering more attractive rates to business travelers who could book later and not have to worry about the Saturday night and still get a good rate. And so the more lucrative end of the market was siphoned off from these traditional carriers, and now some of them are struggling to figure out how to get those customers back.
Right. So that might be one reason why Delta, which is desperate for money, might be taking these fare cuts to get the bulk of the business travelers back. But I'm just an anecdotal observation. Someone who's going to be traveling on Delta and has been trying to call them for 5 days. This is, again, just one observation, but no one's answering the phone. So it seems as if it might defeat their purpose of selling those seats if they don't have anyone picking up
the
phone.
That would be very frustrating for a Delta executive to hear, Robin, because they obviously cut these fares anticipating an avalanche of business, and maybe they're getting it, but they can't even answer all the calls, and they're letting customers go, perhaps.
Right. And will Delta lose this sort of this advantage, this, you know, this idea, this theory of bringing back the flyers if the other airlines respond? And do you think the other airlines will respond?
Well, often when there are these cuts by major carriers, the others reluctantly join and until the next cycle and things change. In this case, these other major airlines, as I said, are holding back because there would be such a big loss of revenue. Some of them simply can't afford the loss of revenue. U.S. Airways, which is operating in bankruptcy, would be unable to suffer a significant loss of revenue. They'd have to liquidate. So you may not see a big rush to join this this party, but it is the risk in the industry.
Right, which is running at a pretty big risk anyway. I mean, two airlines, United and U.S. Airways, are operating while in bankruptcy. So explain to us a little what's happening with them, because we understand that both of those airlines are now pressuring their workers for further concessions on pay and benefits. Will that really make up the difference?
Well, it's a step they need to take to get out of bankruptcy. You have the so-called legacy carriers, the traditional airlines, that have had fairly generous labor contracts and pensions. And the new upstarts, the JetBlues and the Southwests, don't do that. And so that overhead has made it difficult for the traditional airlines to compete. Those in bankruptcy are desperately trying to lower their costs, doing that by cutting their labor agreements, getting out of their pension obligations, and trying to come back with a lean and mean, low operating cost approach to see if they can compete with the new airlines.
Right. So in the meantime, all of this means, you know, maybe better ticket prices, at least, you know, Delta prices initially for flyers, but really bad news for stockholders.
Stockholders have had a tough ride so far. Last year, the first week of the year, the American Stock Exchange Airline Index was down 13%. It's down 1% today, mostly on higher oil prices. But the shares dropped because of the anticipated loss of revenue if this fare cutting mania takes hold.
And Mark, we just have a couple seconds left, so I'm going to put you in the terrible position of reading the tea leaves. What's in the future? What do you think is going to happen? Lose some airlines, higher rates?
Yes, there are too many seats flying around in the sky and not enough bodies to put in those seats. Some of the weaker players will probably have to liquidate and get out of the business.
All right. Mark Mills, Here and Now's financial reporter, with a look at the ailing airline industry. Mark, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. Have a good trip.
And Delta, get some operators. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Here and now with this news note, four top CBS network officials have been fired for their role in a story critical of President Bush's National Guard record. This comes after an investigation into the story showed it was neither fair nor accurate. The story's producer, Mary Mapes, and 60 Minutes Wednesday executive producer Josh Howard were among those fired. CBS Evening News anchor Dan Rather, who narrated the story, announced in November that he would step down, but he claims it has nothing to do with this story. Former Attorney General Dick Thornburgh and former Associated Press director Luis Bocardi were hired to investigate the report. The investigation showed producers rushed the story because they wanted to be first, but the investigation also cleared the network of any political motivations. The story caused controversy before the elections, after it was revealed that the report relied on documents that appeared to have been forged. Case in Orange County, California, pits a Catholic school against a group of parents who want two kindergarten boys at St. John the Baptist expelled. Why? Because the boys' parents are two gay men. St. John's has stood by the gay parents, but the case could end up at the Vatican, and in any event, it has parents on both sides of the issue debating the larger question, who gets to go to Catholic school? Joining us with a hearing of the two sides of the issue are William Donahue, president of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights. Mr. Donahue, welcome.
How you doing?
Good. And Stephen Brady, president of Roman Catholic Faithful. Stephen, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Now, I understand that both of you oppose gay marriage, but Bill Donahue, you think the boys should be allowed to stay at the Catholic school. Why?
Well, there's basically two issues here. One is a matter of principle. The other is a matter of prudence. On the matter of principle, it's part of our Judeo-Christian heritage not to punish the innocent. We punish the guilty. No one has explained to me why these kids are guilty of anything, and of course they're not guilty of anything. The fact that they have gay parents, it does not shine badly on them. They have to be judged on the merits of who they are, and to punish them for the sins of their father is a very un-Christian kind of thing to do. The other thing is a matter of prudence. I mean, where do we draw the line on this? I mean, some of these kids probably have a philanderer as a mother or a father. Some of these kids may have parents who are cohabiting, never got married. Some of them might be may have a mother or father who's a known adulterer. All these people, could argue, are morally delinquent. What are we going to do, start throwing them out as well? I mean, the whole idea is preposterous. These kids should be allowed to stay in the school and keep separate the public policy issue of same-sex marriage.
Well, Stephen Brady, I know you'd like to respond to the charges that this is unchristian and impractical. Let's take the unchristian first.
Well, I think they're punishing the children by keeping them in the school. By that, I mean these kids are going to be eventually, they're going to have to find out if the school teaches what the Catholic faith teaches, that their whole life is a lie, that they should never have been adopted to gay parents, that homosexuality is an abomination. So in that sense, I think it's wrong to keep the kids there, and they're going to be harmed. There's no way around it. On the other hand, there's plenty of good schools out there in the area, I'm sure, and the parents could tell these kids that we're just going to find a better school for you, and they really don't have to be traumatized with all the reasons and the politics behind it.
Well, let's take up the second point as well. Isn't this impractical, as Bill Donahue has said, because don't you have to then expel all students whose parents are divorced or using birth control, et cetera?
Well, I think it comes down to what's publicly known and what's a public scandal. The fact that these fathers are portrayed in the directory, it's my understanding, as two fathers, in and of itself represents a grave scandal. Now, If, for example, there's some situation where parents are cohabitating and these children are all out of wedlock and it becomes a public scandal or publicly known, then I think they would have to be an issue that would have to be addressed by the priest. But obviously, the priest has failed these children. And I agree with Mr. Donahue that the kid shouldn't be punished. But at this point, I think you have to do the most prudent thing, which would be to take him out of harm's way.
That's up for the parents to decide that. I mean, if these two gay guys think it's okay for their kids to be exposed to that, fine. I mean, I don't think we need to have any kind of a feigned interest in whether or not these kids are going to be offended or not. They have to understand that the Catholic Church regards certain behaviors as sinful. But if they're willing to accept that, then that's their choice.
Stephen Brady, what about this Catholic morality pledge that some parents at St. John's are lobbying for?
Well, I think it should be required, but it's more than just something that's come up now at the school. It's come to this point. It's come to this point because the priests haven't been doing their job. There was a day when children like this would not have been baptized in the church, not because there's anything wrong with the children, because the parents in no way could lead or teach the Catholic faith in its entirety. And these homosexual men are using these children, in my opinion, most likely as political pawns.
I was going to ask you that. Do you think that this is just a political move to encroach on what you see as your sacred territory, which is this school?
Well, absolutely. Why would any loving father, or fathers in this case, quote unquote, place their children in an environment that's hostile to everything they believe in and represents your life as an abomination? To me, it can be nothing but a political ploy on the part of the two fathers.
Steve is right to talk about the delinquency on the part of a lot of bishops who have failed us. But at the end of the day, I don't like the idea of singling these kids out because their parents are gay, and as if somehow they are second-class citizens, when we know damn well that they got some of these straight parents out there who are philanderers and they're promiscuous in their own lifestyle, and their kids are allowed to go to school? No, that's just simply unjust.
Do you at all sympathize with Stephen Brady's concerns, or the concerns of other parents who feel that they now have to somehow adjust and be confronted with a lifestyle that they reject?
It's one thing to say these kids are allowed in the school. It's quite another say that you have to accept the lifestyle. So once they cross the line into that, I would say throw the parent out. But again, I make the distinction. The kid did nothing to earn this kind of reprobation, and that's why I think he has the right to stay there.
Well, I think it comes down to the greater good and the teaching of the Catholic faith. And it is unfortunate that children may have to suffer, but I think they suffer more by being kept in the school.
Well, you know, some might say maybe this is a test of the love and compassion of the school, a sense of what would Jesus do?
He would go say, and sin no more, and since they refuse not to sin anymore, some action has to be taken. I don't think these homosexual men are gonna separate and start living a chaste celibate life. And in my opinion, when Jesus would say, go and sin no more, that would require that kind of devotion on their part, which I'm sure they're not willing to enter into.
Bill Donahue, to answer that question, what would Jesus do in your point of view?
Jesus always welcomes people, including the sinners, and does ask them, as Steve correctly pointed out, to repent. That's a condition upon which you are forgiven. But you don't just simply summarily dismiss innocent people, such as these children, and expect them to pay a price for the sins of their father. As Ezekiel in the Old Testament makes it very, very clear, there's such a thing in the Judeo-Christian heritage as personal responsibility, a personal accountability. And again, I say, unless this is a matter of just getting the gays, I want to know what are we going to do about all those drunks and philanderers and promiscuous straight people out there who have their kids in Catholic schools.
Bill Donahue is president of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights. He's based in New York City. Stephen Brady, president of Roman Catholic Faithful. He's based in Illinois. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And there you have it. An entire program without mentioning the breakup of Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt. I bet they're thankful. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now. We'll be right back.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.